Good evening. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the New York Public Library for what promises to be a terrific program, and I'm really sorry you had to go through all those detours to get here. By the time we finish up, that event should be over, and you'll be able to go out through the Fifth Avenue doors. You just either can walk up the stairs or take the elevator up to the main floor of the library. It's particularly fitting, given what Mark and Wendy are going to be talking about, that the library now has a small but glorious exhibition on John Milton at 400, A Life Beyond Life. I urge you to stop by and see it on your way out. It's in the Wachenheim Gallery, which is just to your right as you leave this wing of the building. So at the top of the stairs, if you walk up or out, the guards will tell you where it is if you take the elevator. The curator of the exhibition, William Moek, where is he? Oh, there. You want to stand up? Who is... Hi, Dick. has very kindly offered to station himself in the gallery after the program and answer any questions you may have. It's quite lovely, so I really urge you to do that. Many thanks. And we're also grateful to Susan Rabner, the library's manager of exhibitions, who has generously arranged to keep the gallery open for us after library hours, which is quite a feat. A feat, not the feat. I'd also like to thank Alex Pacheco of the Mark Morris Dance Group for helping us coordinate everything for this evening, and Betsy Bradley, the deputy director of the Coleman Center, who has gracefully handled all the plans and arrangements that went into making this evening work. Mark will be signing copies of the fantastically beautiful book called Mark Morris's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso, ed Il Moderato, A Celebration, after the program. So you will find those outside those doors. And if you would not come up and ask him questions afterwards, let him get out there so he can sign books and you can ask your questions there. Otherwise, there'll be a real traffic jam here. After tonight, the Coleman Center has just one public program this season, which is on Thursday, May 8th at 7 o'clock. Two former Coleman Center fellows, Jeff Tallarico and Jim Shapiro, the Shakespeare scholar. Jeff is a novelist. We'll be talking about Jeff's just-published book, The Ginseng Hunter, which is a spare, beautifully written story about contemporary life on the border of China and North Korea. You'll find this card, which is actually a ginseng flower, with information about Thursday's program on the table as you leave, and you'll also find a sign-up sheet where you can leave us your email address so we can keep you posted about what we're doing in the future. We're completely thrilled to have Mark Morris here tonight to talk with his and my good friend, Wendy Lesser. I'll briefly introduce her, and then she'll introduce him. As many of you know, Wendy's the founding editor of the Threepenny Review, one of the country's great literary periodicals. Threepenny is now 28 years old, which is a terrific lifespan for a small magazine. In listening to Wendy tonight, you'll understand why it has lived so long, if you don't already know. Every issue reflects her intelligence, energy, visual and literary gifts, and her extraordinarily wide-ranging intellectual curiosity. She herself writes extremely well about a wide range of subjects among them theater, art, dance, literature, photography, and music. She's currently working on an original kind of biography looking at Shostakovich's life through his quartets. Her previously published books include a novel, The Pagoda in the Garden, a lovely rumination on rereading called Nothing Remains the Same, a trio of recent essays called Room for Doubt, and a brilliant memoir, The Amateur, An Independent Life of Letters. The Amateur, published in 1999, is not at all in the confessional mode of what currently passes for memoir. It is a fresh, frank, deftly drawn character study of Wendy's intellectual life. She writes that her character, quote, has made me, well, an 18th century man of letters, though one who happens to be female and lives in 20th century Berkeley. Actually, after her year here as a Coleman Center Fellow in 2005-2006, Wendy and her husband kept the apartment they had rented in the Village, and they now divide their year between Berkeley and New York. So it's the 21st century. Wendy is a bicoastal female 18th century man of letters. And I turn the evening over to her and Mark.
Thank So are we audible? We're mic'd? Yes, good. Well, I have the easy task since obviously Mark Morris needs no introduction. And so I don't have to tell you that he's the greatest living choreographer, that he has done way over 100 dances now, full evening as well as short, all in varying degrees masterpieces, that he has a building named after him in Brooklyn where his company works, a building they built themselves. That he also choreographs and directs operas, and that he was the subject at quite an early age of a biography by Joan Acacella. You know all that already if you're here, so I won't introduce Mark, but I will introduce L'Allegro, because some of you might not have seen it. And that is the ostensible reason for our being here tonight, although I hope to ask him questions about things other than L'Allegro, Il Penseroso, ed Il Moderato, and you should feel free to as well when we turn to the question period at the end. Can I just get a sense of how many people in this room have ever seen the evening-length L'Allegro? Wow. Okay, so much for my introduction. I'll rush through it.
You're done.
as most of you already know, it started with two poems by Milton in the 17th century, L'Allegro and Il Penseroso, spoken from the points of view of happiness and melancholy. And then when it got to the 18th century and Handel wanted to set them to music, he had his librettist, Jennens, write a third section, Il Moderato, the 18th century being what it was. They didn't think that merely having the extremes was adequate. And then toward the beginning of the 19th century, William Blake illustrated Milton's Paradise Lost, was it? Or no, he illustrated L'Allegro e Penseroso. And all three of these things, that is, the poem itself, Handel's setting of it, and the Milton watercolors, I guess, went into Mark's making of the piece in 1988. It was the first piece he made after he got a job in Belgium at the Théâtre de la Monnaie. You can pronounce it better than I can. I'm going to say Theatre de la Monnaie, where Gerard Mortier had brought him over from America. He brought his company from America, and they came from relative poverty in New York to this extremely lavish life in Belgium, where they had live music and so forth at their disposal, and he made this great evening-length piece. And then in 1990, it came to America and was performed at BAM in an alternating program with short pieces that have also turned out to be wonderful, long live. The New Love Song Dances, I think, was one of those that was in that.
Oh, and I don't remember. New Love Song Waltzes.
Waltzes, yeah, and that noir piece that film noir.
Wonderland, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I remember that.
Yeah. And there were various wonderful short pieces.
It was Brahms Schoenberg.
Yeah,
that's what it was.
A good combination. And it was the first time I had ever seen Mark Morris and his company. He danced in the short pieces night. He's not in L'Allegro. And I was so amazed by everything that his company did and by everything that he had produced. And I thought, how am I going to express this to this audience? And then, luckily, in this wonderful book that you can buy out in the auditorium afterwards, is a quote from one of Mark's current dancers who happened to go to the performance that night. This is from John Hagenbotham. I first saw L'Allegro by accident. It was 1990, and I was in my first year at Juilliard. I remember the day. A friend of mine at Juilliard asked me, do you want to see the Mark Morris dance group with the White Oak Dance Project? They were alternating shows, L'Allegro and a mixed program. I really wanted to see Baryshnikov dance. He was in the mixed program. And that's the show I thought I was going to see. I got to BAM after a huge day of work and rehearsing. I was still wearing my sweats. We ran. I remember I hadn't eaten anything. We got there to find out that it's not Baryshnikov. It's a 2.5-hour dance piece. And really, my heart sank. I thought, oh, my God, I don't know if I'm up for this. I have to say, it changed my life to see this dance. I left the theater trembling. And not because I was starving. I thought it was one of the most beautiful works of art I'd ever seen. And that was exactly how I felt, but without the sweats. You know? So I thought what we would do, and we hardly need to since you've all seen the piece, but a few of you haven't, and it could start us off, is to show about 5 minutes of L'Allegro, which lasts a whole evening, but we're only going to see Hasty Nymph, which is a dance from the first half of the show, and the finale. And I guess it'll be up here. And then after that, I'm going to ask Mark questions, and he's going to answer them, and then you're going to ask Mark questions.
I haven't said a word. Can I say one thing?
Yes.
If you're sitting next to a reserved for sign, could you remove it? It's very sad. Very sad.
Some of these people, that one, for instance, is sitting back there. So they're here. They're just not in the room.
I can't tell that. Reserved for the president of dance. But she didn't show up.
Right.
Okay, you can roll it if you want
to. Okay, now we're ready. I hope we're not in the way, but we'll find out. So you were 32 years old, and you had only done relatively short dances before, and this is an evening-length piece. Were you scared when you got the idea for this?
No. Sorry. I was probably scared, and that's why I got the idea to do it. I'd been thinking of this music for probably a couple of years. Yeah, I guess a couple of years before I actually did this. I was approached by the Boston Ballet that was then run by Bruce Marks, and who had been done a couple times before with some success, idea of having the Mark Morris Dance Group and the Boston Ballet united in a production that I choreographed that would be called L'Allegro di Penseroso e Moderato. We were started on designs. I had in the not unknown Baroque fashion was going to put the orchestra on a floor above the dancing. Of course, you couldn't see it at all, but I didn't think of that. It would be at the Wang Center, and it would be my company versus the Boston Ballet. And that's been done a few times with varying amounts of success. That choreographer from the 70s, Twyla Tharp, did that once with the Joffrey Ballet. And it fell apart for money, because of money and interest, meaning both of the things were lacking. And then I was absconded. Jerry Mortier, who ran the Monet in Brussels, asked me to come there with my company, believe it or not. He actually just wanted me alone. But I wanted my company, and then he didn't want everyone who worked with me, but it all happened fine, and it was a very good period. The first piece I did, because I had, for the first time, enough money and enough rehearsal time and enough of everything, the question, what would you like to do as a first project, the answer was immediately L'Allegro, and because I'd been studying it and had my hopes on set on doing some version of this piece. So that's what happened. I asked, I found my collaborators, some for the first time, some for not the first time, and we started working on this piece, and then we moved to Brussels, and it took me probably 3 months to put the whole thing together. But I was, it was a nightmare to do. You know, it wasn't fun for anybody, not for me, certainly not for any of the dancers. It was horrific. And it was also for many people, it was the first time I doubled the size of my company. We went from 12 to 24-ish, something like that. And so there were many people I'd never worked with before. And it was really a crucible. And turned out great, but it scared the shit out of me. Yeah.
Did the Belgians like it? Was it one of the pieces they liked as opposed to the ones they didn't like?
Well, you know, there's no such thing as a Belgian.
Oh, all right. The Flems liked it and the French didn't.
That's L'Allegro was a big hit, and not. You know, I don't know. It was hard for me to read. It was, you know, somewhat divided between the Francophone and the Flemophone press. And, you know, there were people who hated the fact that we were there and we're Americans, that we weren't Béjart, et cetera. You know, there was a group of local dancers passing out carnations in front of the theater the opening night, like, you know, you would if you were a Krishna consciousness devotee at the airport. But then we learned that sort of, you know, it's sort of wishing you died. You know, it's like, here.
It's like,
oh, thank you.
Flanders poppies.
Yeah, it was like, oh, here, have a good show. Wait a minute. That's a box cutter, you know. So it was controversial, which I don't really give any, I don't give a speck of interest to that. It was meant to be a gorgeous dance, and it is. I'm sorry you have to watch it on TV, but, you know, this is all about archives, isn't it?
Right. And you'll get the sense of it from hearing Mark talk about
it. Yeah, but that's why I don't watch it. It's like, right. Oh, I wish he didn't do that that little appoggiatura on the first line. Hey, the nymph. Doesn't make sense. It should be the stated first, then the ornaments come later
on. I was going to ask you if you thought they were doing it right, but you answered anyway.
You're doing it right. I just don't like that particular appoggiatura. That's Ian. That's Ian right. Payton, yeah. So, you know, and it's very long if you're not looking at it. It's like, oh my God, will this never end if I turned around for 1 second?
It's anyway. Going to be, it's not long when you see the whole thing on stage. It's going to be live in Seattle this month and a year from now in Berkeley. And those are the only two scheduled performances at the moment. But maybe someday it will come again to a theater near you. And How different was that company 20 years ago from the company now? That is, when you picture how the company now is going to do it later this month in Seattle, what are the pluses and minuses of having these different people?
The plus is I don't picture how anybody's going to do anything. There are people who have never been in it before, and we just started rehearsal today-ish, I think. And so it's being put together right now. So I don't know. I don't go into rehearsal till Thursday, so I have no idea.
Oh, my God.
It's, you know, well, one thing is, they're very good, or they wouldn't be around, and it goes together quite quickly. But when I first did it, it was kind of a funny joke for me. It's not funny in any way, nor is it a joke. But at the time, everyone got a little solo of some sort. One of the jokes is that in L'Allegro, there aren't any solos. That there's every solo has a shadow. Everything's doubled. And, you know, because of the poems that it comes from. So you might do a really long solo, and at the last second somebody else steals your thunder. Or it's everything is doubled and mirrored. There's a lot of that in the whole piece. So, you know, like one of the newer dancers, I gave a giant solo, which is walking into a recit. I mean, during one of the recits in the score, he just makes an entrance walking on a particular sort of phrasing and then stops. And that was, it was his first show with me. I thought, well, that's all I can risk. And other people got gigantic, long, you know, big solo parts.
30-second thin.
No, minutes worth, with occasional other people. But, you know, and that's changed over time, the track of each person going through. You know, it's like when I first made up the Hard Nut, my Nutcracker, if you were had a drop of Asian blood, you were in the Chinese dance.
Very, you know, politically incorrect.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if your name, you know, and had a Z in it, you were in the Spanish dance. So it was completely, you know, I did it as stereotypically, as sort of racially specific as I could. And I did a little bit of, which you couldn't have done in the 19th century, you know?
They wouldn't have been in the company.
Absolutely. So I think it's a wonderful blessing to do the, you know, the Orientalist dances with actual exotic people, you know.
That's a big breakthrough. As opposed to mere Seattleites.
That's right. So you know, the reasons for people getting different tracks in this show have changed. Different people would cover for others. In this manifestation, I'm trying to reestablish more of who did what. Like, if you do this bird dance, you don't do this recitative, etc. So that's just my fun and interesting logic. It doesn't make the dance more interesting, but it does make it more thorough.
Hmm. You always have to audition for this, right? You don't have 24 members?
I don't have to audition.
You never?
I run it. I run the show.
Don't you have to watch the audition?
Oh, yeah, they have to audition, yes.
Can you talk a little, without giving away state secrets, can you talk about how you look for what you look for in dancers? I know that you look for musicality, and that's obvious to anyone that sees them dance, but how do you look for that? How do you
here's my problem. What the hell is that? What does that mean, musicality? You know, it used to be secret code for homosexual.
I wasn't using it that way.
Well, you could. You know, calling Handel, you know, the Orpheus of his time is like. I audition. Here's the sad part is there's a shitload of really good dancers all over the place. The sad part is they're being dumped into a market that, you know, it's like a, you know, it's like the Coinstar machine when you take all of your jars of coins and go to the store. Not only do you find out that you had a bunch of foreign coins and it takes hours, but then it takes like 12%. And that's what it's like with an audition. It's like, okay, everybody, go. And then hours and days later, there's not just a few, surprise coins from another land, but there's also a receipt showing that you were ripped off. So,
Are you speaking as the dancer or the...
Yes, yeah. I am. And so you get gorgeous dancers, some of whom work out and some of whom don't. But really, we had the latest auditions we did, we saw many hundreds of people, you know, like 400 or 500 people is not unusual. And it's awful because auditions are awful. So we make it last as long as we can, meaning we let people dance because not everyone dances well at gunpoint.
Do they come with a prepared dance or do you teach them a dance?
No, it's all what we give them. So sometimes it's a bar or a class to warm people up and then material that's varied in its degree of difficulty and specificity. You know, walking shows you something, turning shows you something, learning something on the spot shows you something else. So the musicality part we just hope for. I think we just spot it as sort of rhythmicity, and clarity and maybe versatility. And if that turns into something that relates to a musical gesture, as I hope it will, if you're going to be in my damn dance, then that doesn't always show right away. Or sometimes that's the only thing that shows. Somebody can't walk on the beat except they have something musical about them. And we don't know. Sometimes
if they can't walk on the beat, do you ever hire them?
Yeah, because sometimes, well, you know, there not many singers can walk on the beat because they're also told not to because it's not natural looking. I don't know why, like drifting, like a log jam across the stage is more natural. I don't know and understand that. Anyway.
This shifts us into a different gear for a second, but...
Log jam? Where did that come from, I'm wondering? Sorry.
But a good image.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah. You recently used singers as dancers and some of your dancers as singers in King Arthur. Did you know that your dancers could sing before you had them do that?
Certainly.
I mean...
Oh, yeah.
Did they sing around the office a lot? I mean, how do you know which ones can sing?
Oh, we sing all the time. Yeah, everybody sings all the time. We can do Dido and Aeneas with no professionally trained singers if we need to. If there's somebody on the piano, and we can sing all the parts. It doesn't sound great, but it's very it's very accurate. Yeah, so, and, you know, in that production of King Arthur, I did what I thought would work. You know, the dancers who sing, everybody had to sing. You sing whatever part you're comfortable with. But we know they're singing them. They're singing soprano, alto, tenor, and bass.
And audibly, from the audience, yeah. You can hear them. Mm-hmm.
And the singers who dance a little bit, you know, I don't want them to get hurt. So we do, you know, we arrange it so that everything
square
works
square dancing,
out.
Which
I'm not trying to... I'm not trying to make everybody a double or triple threat, but I think, you know, it's a song and a dance.
And do you think choreographing... Let's call King Arthur an opera. It's not quite an opera, but whatever it is. Certainly Orfeo and Eurydice is
in what way is it not an opera?
It doesn't have an attempt at a plot. I mean, you have made it into something that is not quite an opera by cutting out all the
plot
parts.
Because the plot is a play.
Yeah,
so, okay, all right,
exactly.
I agree with you.
So now
it's a musical.
Or a vaudeville series of events or a bunch of dances strung together with people singing.
But I agree with you.
It's not, it's done, oh, good. Anyway, how is it different doing...
I mean, it's not an opera like Four Saints in Three Acts.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay.
All right, so...
All right, no, I agree with you. Stop
you
while
win.
I still agree with you.
How is it different doing something where the singers are that present on the stage versus something like this where you have them down in the pit, I believe, right? And the dancers are the only thing people are looking at.
Well, first of all, thank you for not using the overused term banished. Everybody says that, and the singers were banished to the pit. It's like, oh, God. That means you can read the score. You don't have to memorize anything.
Yeah, right.
The banished to the pit part, well, it's a whole different thing. And, you know, the pieces where the singers are banished to the pit are Dido and Aeneas, for example, and this piece. But I also, you know, I've worked with vocal music for many, many years because I like it. So, you know, I rarely have the, you know, I don't like to do the, you know, the soprano in the crook of the piano, you know, with the gown preparing to sing and the dance being a thought balloon. I don't like that. So I try not to do that. So when I stage something with dancers and singers, like, the way I did this Orpheus and Eurydice at the Met is an example where usually the I don't need the chorus to do a great deal of action because I have dancers that I like to use for that reason. So dancers are quicker footed and can shift gears more easily. So like in Dido or in this, or if I were directing a Peter Grimes, you know, the choruses are used so frequently and so for such short bits of time that that's the reason Peter Grimes always looks like it's set at a Red Lobster restaurant with a crowd of people just, you know, eating bottomless shrimp because they have to sing every couple of minutes and how do you get them on and off, really? That's what it is. So I don't like that so much. So I very often, even if I'm using singers in a production, I put the chorus where they... Well, sort of out of the way, but sound great. And then they don't have to worry about getting up off their knees.
It was wonderful in Orfeo to have them ringed like
that. Yeah, wonderful.
And was that your idea to design that set like that?
It was it was Alan Moyer, the set designer's idea to design the set, and me, you know, but, I mean, all of us did it together.
How much? Let's talk about the sets in L'Allegro.
Now I have to finish the Orpheus thing.
Then finish.
what I said to Maestro Levine, who is, by the way, if you think he's fabulous, you're wrong. He's like so super, super fabulous. That's what I have to tell you. He's not merely fabulous. He's out of this world. Anyway, I said one thing that I hate when I go to the opera. Well, there's several things I hate, but one thing that I really hate is when the stairs look like they're marble, but they sound like wood. So when they're walking around, they should be going clink, 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 and they're going talk, talk, talk. And why do they have all those stairs anyway? Because every show has like 7 flights of stairs, and that drives me nuts. And the other thing is Orpheus and Eurydice needs to be, because it's mostly a solo number, it needs to be very far downstage. Yeah. And Maestro Levine's idea to use 100 choristers. He said, well, let's use a big chorus. I said, well, sure, that's fine with me. A big chorus to me is like 60 people. He said, well, how about 100? Okay, fine. So we put them in this sort of amphitheater downstage to cone the sound for the theater, because I wasn't going to have them really do a lot of stuff. There's no reason to. So anyway, no stairs. I wanted no intermission, and I wanted no prompter's box. And I got those things. And he wanted 100 people and downstage, and we got what we wanted. So, anyway.
And then just to get a sense of how you work with your designer, how much instruction did you give to Adrienne Lobel, and how much did she make up, and how much did you change what she made up in the sets for L'Allegro?
I don't remember what happened first. First, of course, is the music. Adrienne Lobel, who did the sets, James F. Ingalls, who's the most lighting designer around. He does every single show you've ever seen. In fact, he probably did this. We'd be in the dark.
We would look more glamorous.
I know.
Yeah.
And the costumes for this, Christine von Loon, who I worked with in Brussels. Anyway, I recall Adrienne giving me, like, this size. What's that? 3x3 little squares of watercolors that... had a little bit to do with Albers, and had a little bit to do with Rothko, and had a little bit to do with, you know, just fooling around. Her first and last idea was to use color fields. So she just did a bunch of different color combinations, a green swath on the bottom for, you know, land, and a blue swatch on top for sky, and things much more and less literal than that. So I had many, many pages of these watercolors, and she proposed doing them, which is how it ended up, as various degrees of opacity, so that they're scrims, you know, meshy ones, and then painted drops. And what I agreed with that because I thought it was a gorgeous idea. So they're raised to different raised and lowered to different levels. You see through as sometimes as many as 4 layers of fabric, and of course it was the Monet. We had a full week in the theater with a pianist and a full crew, trying these different moves with no dancers, and it's a rope house too. Everybody does it. It's not. It was computery. Yeah, because we've done it in both. So to time it so it arrives exactly at this cadence, it hits the floor without making a noise. And but you know, it's like it's super complicated. There are 21 of these drops and scrims. Mm-hmm. But the super complicated for me was, you know, because also she would just never stop. If I didn't say, like, that's enough, it would never stop moving. It would never happen the same way twice. You'd be like, you would just, like, finger paint all night. So I had to draw the line somewhere, and we threw out a few pieces. But the tricky part was to decide, because I had to do that in advance, of how much depth each dance would take. Because if you're bringing something into the floor, you may have just 8 feet in between it and 24 people trapped. So we did... The only time that the stage is completely wide open is...
The end.
It's for the end, but it's also for the moderato pieces, the two moderato pieces. They have nothing else that's in at the floor, so they're fully open, and the finale is just because that's the end. Mm-hmm. There are parts where people are in very small passages and corridors, and then it opens up to big depth, and that's it. So I said, I like that, and I don't like that. And I said, that's one too many things. And
finished was the dance when she started showing you all these scrims?
It wasn't begun.
Okay, good. So in other words, then you could move them where you wanted in relation to what she'd given
you.
So
when we first did it, we had pieces of wood. What's that called? What do you call that piece? A piece of wood. What's that called? Like a 1x4 with tape of the appropriate color stretched across so you would trip on it and know how far. Because, of course, when it's a tape mark, now we do it with tape marks on the floor, but a tape mark on the floor representing a wall is very difficult. You know, then you get on stage and you're behind a wall. Hmm. And it's, you know, the light shows you, but you sometimes can't see out to the audience. So you could be facing the wrong way. It's possible.
So another...
Sorry, that's the end of my answer.
To go from the completely abstract to the narrative, mm-hmm. everybody is always seeing stories in your work. Sometimes, I think, when they're not there. When I took my students to your rehearsal of Mozart dances, they saw so many stories there that I had never seen before. They saw businessmen rushing to work with their briefcases. Are those in there? And they saw people taking naps and then be woken up by the nap fairy, who I think was Lauren. Anyway, they saw a lot of things I hadn't seen before, but...
Well, you need to find a story in something to get to be able to watch it.
They do, and they were convinced, and they persuaded each other that these stories were there, too. But here, I feel like the stories have actually been put in there. Do you care to talk about the explicit and implicit stories of the different plots, the different scenes that are going on in L'Allegro?
Well, let's
see. I offer it purposely that way in case you don't care.
Yeah. No, I... Well, I don't like to tell that kind of story, but, you know... there are passages that are quite directly narrative. This happens and this happens. Or more, even better for dancing, I feel like this. That's easier to get, you know, that makes more sense than, you know, then he walked downstage, right, left, although that's not Milton. It is how dancing interprets poetry, because that's all you've got, really, is right, left. I don't know. There's scenes, these sort of evocative scenes. There's the hunting scene with you know, I wanted to make it look, although we have no props or drops or anything. I'd be so much happier if you're shooting me, oh photographer. If you're shooting her, that's great. If you're shooting me, don't you can't use anything from the profile. Okay, good, because I have to be from the other side, but you know that. You can tell by looking from that side. Okay. There's a thing that talks. There's one that sort of talks about hunting, and you know, there's horn, and you know, so I made up a scene that is people hunting. You know, so I have foxes, and you know, I have a hunting. I have trees and shrubberies, and I have
people who are trees and shrubberies.
Well, they're all people. Yeah, everybody's a person.
I'm telling anyone who hasn't seen it.
Oh, I'm saying that I made up the scenery that's made of people. Because I wanted to also, I wanted it to look like Drottningholm. I want it to look like Baroque theater where the trees slide on like this and the waves are in a corkscrew and, you know, the costume disappears into a hole in the floor and people fly in. But there was none of that sort of advanced Baroque technology that I wanted in the show. There's nothing. There's no furniture. There's no special effects except through lighting and through these color planes and through human beings doing stuff. So that's, you know, that's fine, and that's one. Everybody's like, oh, ha, that's so, I love the hunting part, that's so funny. It's like, okay, fine. So you remember that stuff. But then the Moderato things, for example, these two very big dances, Ez Steele's The Morn Upon the Night, which is the only duet for soprano and tenor in this beautiful piece of music, that I decided to make those pieces, what's the other one? What's the other one called? Each Action, yeah. Okay, those are the two Moderato pieces, and they're both for everybody in the cast, full 24-person dances, and they are the most sort of abstract, if a dance can be abstract, it has people in it. So they're very symmetrical. They're these pattern dances, but the one for each action shall derive new grace. The action motifs are earth, water, fire and air. Hmm. And so the moves, you know, you don't have to know that. It's not in the text in any way, but that's how I use those motifs of those four elements in many of the other places in the piece. It's just here they're in their fullest, clearest, most abstractified kind of thing. It's like, oh, that is this and this is this. These four elements that then are used throughout the piece in all different manifestations in the text.
And do you tell
that? So it becomes part of the gesture language, that's all.
When you teach the dancers the dance, or when you make the dance with them, do you tell them everything that's in your mind of that kind? What themes have gone into making each piece?
No, I don't need to. I'd be talking all day. which I do anyway. But, you know, it's like, no, do this move. And they,
and
you
they
know,
can
they
figure
recognize,
it out themselves.
Yeah, they're not real dumb. Or at all. But, you know, it's also, it's hard to, but I, you know, I want those things to have their own gestural integrity. Not just gestural. I had an interview yesterday where we got into a fight about steps versus, like, I don't know, moves or something. You know, it's like, I don't, because in a rehearsal, I will say, I'll call something an arabesque or, you know, a squat or something. And that somehow, to this person I was talking to, made that a step. Whereas the storytelling bits, the gesture stuff, the geometry, the spacing, which is how I prefer to tell stories, by where people are, that's very important to me, no matter what they're doing. But, you know, then that became the whole thing of, like, is walking a step or is it a gesture? It's like, you know, I don't know. That becomes the what's dancing, what's musical. But because we have French terms for some of these steps, those become the steps instead of the whole piece is a step and the whole piece is in a rhythm that's 2.5 hours long instead of just by bar. So the bigger pictures come to people who are willing to look at them, who are in, you know, just because you're a dancer doesn't mean you're interested in choreography. You know, you're interested in dancing. And you needn't. Not very few people are actually choreographers. Fewer than you would think.
Fewer than that are practicing it.
Keep practicing. No, there just aren't many of us. That's why we all get along. If we were all trapped at the choreographer's lounge at the airport, which has happened in San Francisco, we would all be very happy and fine. It wouldn't be a problem. There might be some eye rolling, but there wouldn't be fights. Anyway, so that's the thing where if you want to know more about it, for example, you come here and you can ask me a question, one can, but also if you watch carefully what other people are doing, and this is how one reason my company is different from other companies, is that they know what everybody else is doing. You don't just know your part because all my work doesn't just face front. And it's like, I don't care what they're doing back there, but look at this gorgeous turn I'm about to do. Hmm. You know, there's a lot of that in the dance world, and to me that's a little not interesting. So my dancers all have to, they're forced to cooperate by the nature of the work. And then whatever else goes on is their problem. But the big picture of the piece is up to each individual. Mm. They're making it happen, but they may not all necessarily know the role, the part that they're making happen.
This reminds me that you've recently taken up conducting under mm-hmm. the tutelage of Jane Glover, and I think you've done your own conducting of Dido and Aeneas, is mm-hmm. that right? Can you compare that role to being a choreographer at all?
Well, what I say is I just finished conducting Dido, and boy, are my arms tired.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. it's not, well, it's interesting because it's not performing, you know, and you're facing, in case you're wondering, you're facing the other direction. So it makes me so nervous and crazy. It's so difficult. And it was fun. It's fun. It's exhilarating. And I don't know if I'm good enough at it to get through the show. You know, nothing horrible happens. But it's difficult and scary. And you can't listen and enjoy it. I mean, I wouldn't be doing that if I was watching anyway. I know how everything works. But if you stop to listen, the needle just slides right off the record. So it's pretty... I have more responsibility than I thought I would. I thought that everybody, you know, being fabulous musicians, they just like sort of play and
wouldn't need to pay
and
attention
I'll step
to you.
Away for a little bit, and that's not true.
Right.
So,
in a minute, I'm going to throw this open to the audience and let them ask questions.
Already?
So, no, not yet.
My God.
I have a couple more, but
right,
I'm warning
okay.
them because what happens if you do it as a surprise is they don't raise their hands. So I'm saying, start thinking about your questions. Be ready to ask them when I get through with my next two.
And be sure it's in the form of a question.
And not too long. So
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about... Sorry.
I wanted to ask one more question about L'Allegro and then on a completely other subject. The one about L'Allegro is, at what stage in making up the whole dance did you decide to put the happiness movement at the end? He tends to relocate sometimes. He decides the composer has put it somewhere that it doesn't work so well for the dance. So you did this in King Arthur. You put that...
There's no urtext of King Arthur.
Oh, there is none?
That
my recording has the maypole dance,
that's
not
that's your ur recording, yeah. And they're all different.
Yeah, I see.
No, that piece of music can be dropped in almost anywhere.
But Handel ended it with Moderato, didn't he?
And then also dropped Moderato. they performed this piece with the Moderato section, which is frankly too long, a little bit boring, not the best music, and the text isn't as good. So I put this edition together with the great, great, and unfortunately recently late Craig Smith from Emmanuel Music in Boston. We did this together, and we dropped a couple of arias that didn't seem like they were going to work. We do a version that can be alto or mezzo. We usually do just sopranos and tenor and bass, but we also have a version that's slightly different for a mezzo or for a countertenor. And it was pretty early on that we decided how to balance the piece and to make it into the two halves of the program. I knew I wanted to use just a little bit my favorite pieces of Moderato. You know, as I was saying, that he handled in performance in his own life, dropped Moderato. It wasn't mandatory. It wasn't as good. Nobody knew it. And, you know, you could shift things around. Craig and I decided, you know, the overture, which is one of Handel's Concerti Grossi, we used to do two movements at the top and then a movement in the middle as an entr'acte at the end of intermission, and it just seemed like too much. So it changed a little bit over time. I cut, there was an optional like 8 or 16 bars in one of the pieces that you can use or not. There's a repeat scheme in one of the bird numbers, Sweet Bird, that is open. You know, it was written for different singers at different times. There are many possibilities. But I decided that I didn't want to end all gloomy and sad and everything. That's how I end Act 1. And so then you get to come back for Act 2 to get the payoff. You know, as I say in rehearsal sometimes, when we're rehearsing the finale and it's early on and everybody's tired because they've been going all day, it's like, you know, you're acting like you're going to get a standing ovation. You know, it's like you don't just get to say that. And, of course, you kind of can. You play the national anthem. You hold up a basket of puppies. You know, there are certain things that will make people stand up. A flag and some misty-eyed, you know, whatever.
A subway to catch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, an airport. You know, there are lots of things that can make people stand up and cry. And that's easy to do, but you don't want to see that coming from too far away or it just cloys. And so to keep the dancing direct and authentic and gorgeous, and to end on such a sort of happy note, you know, that takes balls to do that.
It is a happy note. And now to move to something completely different, one of the things that I often get from Mark is recommendations as to what to read and what to watch on television. Reading, for instance, he discovered for himself, but then transmitted to me Stanley Elkin, who I had never read and who I've now read everything I can find by.
Read Stanley Elkin if you haven't, everybody. It's just so great.
He is.
Oh, it's great.
So what other book recommendations do you have for me now, and what TV recommendation? I have a TV recommendation
okay,
for you,
go.
Which is a Canadian series called Slings and Arrows.
Saw it.
Okay.
It's
well,
good.
You, isn't it great?
And it gets a little Canadian for me, but it's really good.
Does it go into Romeo and Juliet at all? Did you get it?
I didn't see all of it. I just saw some of it.
Oh, you should watch the whole thing.
Yeah, okay.
You'll get addicted. But tell me what I should watch and tell me what I should read.
My favorite TV show always, and I don't know, it's been on for 40 or 50 years, is America's Funniest Home Videos. And I can have seen that three-year-old hit his dad with the baseball bat, and I see the skateboarder straddle the railing. You know, I've seen all of this. Or the swimming pool that just collapses and gives forth all of its water at the same time. It's always funny. I'm at home alone, like, really doubled over in laughter. And that happens every single time. It never doesn't work. Anyway, that's an awfully good one. I watch, like everybody else, the boring thing. Everybody else watched the unbelievable show called The Wire.
Yes. You didn't like
shocking.
It?
Shocking. No, it was great, but everybody knows that one.
Yeah, everyone
Not
knows
everybody
that.
Knows, you know, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Not everybody knows The Backyardigans. Unless you have a three-year-old, you don't know The Backyardigans, which is a very, very fine children's show that's a half an hour long musical. It's just the most spectacular thing. The Backyardigans is my big. I'm a little over it. I've outgrown it a little bit because I've seen all of them, and the target audience is really 4 years old.
And now that you're five.
But they're beautiful. They're beautiful. Really wonderful.
All right, good. And a book?
A book. Well, I just read in the last 5 minutes Aram Sarayan's complete minimal poems. Which I just loved so much. And let's see, I was reading Narayan, that wonderful Indian novelist. I was sharing books with a friend. I don't know. I was in sort of a magazine hole for a while because I've been on a lot of airplanes.
Okay, good. A good big fat book, if you want to take it on the airplane, is The Mayas by Itza de Quiroz. It's just retranslated. New Directions has brought it out in paperback. It's like the Mayan Indians, only with an I instead of a Y.
Is that the Mayas. Original spelling?
Yes, Portuguese, The Mayas.
Oh,
it's the name of the family. It's set in 19th century Lisbon. It's great. I guarantee it.
But you're a real Portuguese queen, aren't
you?
No,
I'm not, no.
Oh,
no.
I thought you
were.
Okay.
I was converted by this book.
Wow, okay, good.
Okay, audience, this is your chance to ask Mark whatever you want. And you were warned, too. Do you want to call on them or shall I?
You can.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jacek Mysiński. I'm a pianist and also conduct and compose. And I want to relate a little bit to this question when you said about conducting. I was asked many times by dancers specifically if the conducting in any way relates to the choreography of the movement. And what was your experience when you went out on the podium to conduct? Did you have any? Did you use any of your experiences? Any of your feeling of the space and
Well, here's the reason I dared to conduct is because I end up coaching musicians all the time because I only work with live music. Music with living people involved. I work with music and musicians all the time, and I coach them. You know, I use a lot of chamber music, so we don't require a conductor, but it's like, you know, can it be more like this? I end up doing that, and then it ends up like, well, how come nobody else can do that? And so the preparation that it takes, and also preparing a new conductor, if I have a new conductor coming in to do a piece we've been doing for a while, the preparation is intense and extreme, and it's difficult. I learned that I knew enough, and just my listening, people responding to me listening to them play, and I was doing too much, I was over-listening. You know, when you're at the concert next to somebody who's like, you know, it's like, oh, I love that part, you know. Never do that, first of all. So that's what I kind of did in rehearsal. I realized that I was giving a lot of information without really knowing it. So, you know, I did some coaching with several different people, Craig Smith being one of them, and I learned, you know, sort of rudimentary stick technique, because that's all anybody really has anyway. They're just lying. Everybody's lying. But I knew the music so well, in Dido and Aeneas in particular. I know it so well because I used to dance the big part. And so I know it corporeally. So, you know, it's like when we first worked with Mr. Ma, the cellist, Yo-Yo Ma, perhaps you've heard of him. We did a piece to the third cello suite, the C major Bach cello suite, and he would send me recordings of him playing it on the road, and he would come to rehearsal and is, you know, playing it with the dancers. And, you know, I said, this has to be a little bit slower to actually be a saraband, or it has to be faster to be a gigue. So just, you know, fundamental tempo stuff, not even you're flat or you're late, but also what if it had this swing to it? And that not only made his playing of it better, I don't like that, made the playing of it better, he also remembered it in a different way and saw that, you know, every conductor and every musician says that was the same speed I did last night. It's like, you know, and people think that tempo is all it's about with dancing. It's not, but it sure makes a difference. That's the only way you can really ruin a show, is by being way too fast or way too slow. If it sounds like shit, that's your problem. We can still do what we need. So what happened was, you know that this, the loft, you know, that gravity and jumping, like if it's slower than this, it can't be done, or it changes the heart of it so much that why bother? You know, really, it's a waltz until it gets slow enough, and then it's a Landler, you know, or then it keeps going up, it turns into a minuet, you know. It's like, they're rough terms, but they really, if there's dancing involved, and that's how I learned the music, then I've got that, you know, I have that swing. And of course, I'm too fast and too slow in alternation, but it has the right sort of physical property, yeah. Sure. Are you Polish?
I am.
Okay, just guessing.
There was another question Yeah.
And so I gather that the music is the starting point in your dances. And I sometimes wonder, does this mean that every time you hear a piece of music that you like, you start envisioning some sort of movement? Or if you hear a piece of music that you like, do you think of doing a dance to it because it helps you understand the music better?
Well, a couple things. I'm not so psychotic that if I hear music, a dance happens in my head. And I have to put on the aluminum foil helmet. That, you know, I've always said that my mother, my fabulous mother, always had dreams about flying and about dancing. I've never had one. I have dreams about, like, screeching to it, like landing, but not, I get the part where I land. I have the turbulence. I don't have the free flying around thing. And dancing, what's that movie? Spinal Tap, where I just can't find the stage, where the dance is happening, and I can't find the entrance, really. They're anxiety dreams, perhaps, yeah. But that's how they relate to show business. So really, if I hear a piece of music, I don't even have to like it. I can want or not want to make up a dance to a piece of music just because it strikes me or because it reoccurs to me 30 years later. It's like, wait, what was that? Oh, of course. Let me make up a dance.
What have you choreographed to a piece of music you don't like?
Oh, I didn't say that.
I thought you said you didn't have to like it.
I don't have to like it to think that it could make up a dance. Oh. No, I've done music that I don't think is great, that is perfect for a dance. Definitely. Like mostly older ones when I worked with recorded music more. Tamil film songs and stereo pas de deux. That Jean Francais piece isn't the greatest music in the repertory. You know, there's some stuff that I use specifically to make up a particular dance. Mm-hmm. That sometimes if I have some sort of a tone or a story in mind, but mostly not. Usually it's music strikes me somehow, and I think I couldn't make it worse by putting a dance with it. Because really, it has the effect sometimes, at least with me. Once I make up a dance to a piece of music, I rarely listen to it again. Like, it's sort of ruined, you know. I don't have to seduce it anymore. I don't have to take it out to dinner. It's like, it's breakfast, and I'm not interested anymore. So, I have a huge volumes and volumes of Chopin to prepare myself to do the one Chopin piece I've ever done. And I love that music, and I have it. But the thing is that it's a decision to make up a dance, and I have to like the music, or the music has to be good enough, according to me, to bear hundreds and thousands of repetitions, of listening, of studying it, of puzzling over it. You know, the parts of the... I've just finished this Romeo and Juliet of Prokofiev that's coming up, and I just pretty much finished it, meaning that there's as much dancing as there is music. It still takes some adjustment. But I sort of start the parts of the music that I don't get or don't like, or the Ohrwurm, the irritating music that I can't get out of my head, that's what I very often start with to purge myself. And I save... You know, I eat the vegetables first, so I can find the language of a dance. That's not an answer in any way to your question.
Close
but
enough.
I meant it to be. Okay.
Deborah?
You have a great interest in Indian music. Mm-hmm. Since you were in NYC playing Indian music for a week, all the stuff.
Wasn't that a good show?
No, sometimes I couldn't listen to it, but it was.
Oh, great. That's a sign of a great radio show. You mean Lou Harrison?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Anyway, but I'm wondering, you seem to be very passionate, and I know you've been to India and visited, and it is a fascinating place. Of course. Anyway, have you any interest in doing any dance pieces?
I have. Well, that's the same thing.
Volumes and volumes, and you'll have
It's been years, you know. I go to India every couple years now because I can. I used to want to go because I went there accidentally and I loved it so much. And so I go with some frequency. I'm very familiar, I would call myself even an amateur of South Indian music, of Carnatic music. I'm not an expert, but I know enough. And I go to the music festival in Chennai when I'm there, and go to 3 or 4 concerts a day and listen to music. There's some dancing, but I'm there for the music, because really I'm way more interested, in case you haven't gotten this, I'm way more interested in music than I am in dancing. So I go there, I have friends who are musicians and dancers and, you know, impresarios, and I immerse myself in this music, which I love. I have a big collection at home, and I'm not, at this point in my life, interested in learning the techniques of those dances. You know, those days are long gone. But I understand them sort of well, and I, of course, that's influential in my own work. I'm not doing, you know, as much as, say, classical ballet is, or flamenco, or folk dancing from various places. You know, I use very few citations, direct citations of work, but I'm influenced. In one way, I've said this about Indian dance, one thing I love about it that is causes consternation with American dance critics talking about my work, that why does it have to be on the beat and why does it have to go with the music? It's like, well, I kind of like that. You know? In India, this is probably a horribly racist thing to say, but nobody I've encountered sings out of key. If you do, everybody's like, oh, shut up, you sound horrible. You know, but there's like this wonderful tradition of singing that's very complicated to me and very specific, and the same with drumming. If somebody's playing the mridangam, it's like, oh, God, you should be a singer instead. You can't drum at all because no one's offbeat. I mean, if you're at a certain level of development, it's like you wouldn't, it's like, you know, don't cook, your food tastes horrible. Do something else instead. And I get that experience, and I'm working, you know, not just with very high-level professional dancers and musicians, but with kind of everybody I meet. And it's a very interesting thing. It's like, you know, and it wasn't until the 60s or something in the States where there was this ugly divorce between rhythm and music and dancing. It was like, oh, God, you're kidding. You can't use music. Ugh. And that's never been interesting to me. I've wanted to dance in response to at least rhythm, if not music. And so my work is all like that. It's not because I have no other choice. It's the choice that I make because it gives me great pleasure. And as far as I see it, about 99% of the Earth's population dance to music or dance to rhythm. It's like, what are you doing? Can't you hear what's going on? Anyway,
good.
It bothers some people.
I think that is actually an excellent place to end because it's some... Oh, no, oh. No, they're desperate. All right. I've been told we have to get out of here, but all right, we can have one or two more. Let's try someone way back. Yeah. Shout.
Just a sec.
For listening to music, which may become a ballet, do you prefer live concerts or your own disc collection?
Well, I much prefer concerts, certainly. You know, that's the thing. The audiences now are so shocked when they hear how quiet a string quartet is and that they have to tune because you're used to your iPod on the airplane where you turn it up to block other things. It's like, oh, no, that's not the full use of music as far as I'm concerned. I have a big record collection because I'm also... a little bit agoraphobic, but I do go to concerts a lot, but I also work with live music all day long in my job. You know, I don't rehearse with recorded music. I have a pianist for everything, and so I'm very adamant about not using someone's specific reading of a piece of music. So when I make up, like this Prokofiev I'm working on, it's a new, recently discovered original concept of Prokofiev. So it's not the exact score that we're all used to. It's different. And I haven't listened to the other one in months. I'm working with a pianist and finding the tempi that we need and knowing what the orchestration is. So it's imaginative. And then when it becomes a performance, it's fully realized in a way that is not that CD I ordered from Tower right before they went bankrupt.
There was a question over here.
Is there any music you won't use on there? Because, not because you don't like it, but because it's a piece of music that doesn't require a dance? I mean, I'm thinking I saw a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, which really doesn't need dance.
Did you see a dance performance of the St. Oh, okay, well then you're right. Okay. Oops. There's some stuff that, well, you know, I had a friend who was a sort of a choreographer for a little while. Now he's a nurse. He was a monk in between. That just tells you something. Okay. He decided.
See the progression.
What?
You can sort
yeah,
of see.
Well, he was my lover before that. Lover, monk, choreographer, nurse. Okay. Anyway, I'm not sure. Okay. Anyway, he set out to choreograph a series of the over choreographed pieces of music at the time, which were the Barber something and the Albinoni something.
Oh, yeah.
And the Vivaldi something and probably the Phil Glass something. You know, it's like or probably one of the cello suites. You know, it's like what music has every single person choreographed in college and maybe looks back now with a little tear of regret or, and so he went through these giant pieces of music. There's music that I don't think should be choreographed by me, but you know, I'm open to anything. It can turn out fine. You know, it was a St. Matthew Passion actually 30 years ago, and I thought, wow, that's incredible. And you cast yourself as Christ? Wow! Hooray for you! It was terrible. It was terrible. Made me like the music better. Yeah.
All right, this is it. We have to tear him out of here, but he's going to be signing L'Allegro books out there in the corridor, lobby, whatever that is. So you can have at him again out there. But thank you very much for being an
audience. Thank you.
And thank you.